Welcome to Conscious Voices, a weekly program dedicated to bringing you alternative points of view and to challenging popular assumptions in order to help you be better informed and civically engaged. I'm Evan Davis, your host for this edition. I had hoped to have a contribution from another volunteer this week, but apparently that fell through. Producing public affairs radio programs is a lot of work. It's rewarding in many ways, but it's a pretty big commitment that not everyone is cut out for, and that's why we need volunteers here. The greater the number of people who participate, the less work any one person will have to bear. I attended a demonstration on Wednesday organized by students at the from the Freedom School, which called for an end to the Ohio Public Schools zero-tolerance policy in relation to student discipline. And audio from that event is in today's show. I also want to express condolences for the victims of the latest mass shooting, this one in Tennessee, where a young shooter armed with a semi-automatic rifle targeted two military facilities in Chattanooga, killing four people and wounding several others. Not much is known about the assailant, who was also killed. We don't know his motives. Unlike Dylan Roof, the known and public white supremacist who killed nine people at the AME Church in Charleston, South Carolina, and who left a long trail of publicly available evidence prior to his crime, the shooter, in this case, apparently offered no kind of warning. Meanwhile, another mass shooter armed with a semi-automatic weapon, or weapons, who killed a number of people several years ago at a movie theater in Colorado, was convicted this week of first-degree murder, the jury in that case having rejected a not-guilty-by-reason-of-insanity plea. I wonder, however, what the police in Texas will plea if charges are filed after an investigation into the in-custody death of Black Lives Matter activist Sandra Bland. Bland was driving to Texas for a job interview when she was pulled over for allegedly failing to use the turn signals when changing lanes. A civilian cell phone video of her arrest shows police officers tackling her to the ground, and she's heard to complain about having her head slammed into the ground. She was allegedly found dead of asphyxiation in a jail cell 2 days later. Her family and friends say that she was not suicidal, and although the police say she hung herself, there has been no reference to evidence of a noose or any other implement of self-strangulation. According to today's Democracy Now!, a petition calling upon the Justice Department to investigate this case as a homicide has received more than 50,000 signatures so far. And speaking of signatures, the Dispatch reports that the commercial lobby group Responsible Ohio, which gathered more than twice the needed number of signatures to place a controversial marijuana legalization bill on the statewide ballot, apparently had an abnormally high proportion of invalid signatures. So many that it might actually come up short of the number of valid signatures needed, despite having spent millions of dollars on its investors' money to hire hundreds of petitioners across the state. I encountered a number of those petitioners in a number of places, including at this year's community festival, where some of the signature gatherers were lying about the purpose of the petition, claiming that it would make recreational marijuana completely legal. It wouldn't. The bill would ensconce marijuana as a controlled substance subject to strict limitations, most notably that only marijuana grown by one of 10 named and licensed growing facilities in the state would be allowed and could only be sold at one of just under 2,000 proposed licensed retail facilities. For this reason, opponents of the bill have complained that it would effectively create a private monopoly to profit from the newly sanctioned commodity. Another petition that would place an initiative before voters in Columbus to elect the city council in part by districts, rather than having all council seats be elected at large, is running into some resistance from the city administration. We'll follow that story as it progresses. And the Community Bill of Rights petition were submitted to at the beginning of the month, having topped their signature-gathering goal at ComFest. We have audio from that press conference and the rally and more right after this week's Cole Report.
This is the Cole Week in Review. As reported this week in the Whitesburg Mountain Eagle, the Norton Coalfield Progress, other area newspapers, and internet sources.
Well, I'm down in the old coal mine, hammering and beating time, long for the sun, just to see it shine. And I'm down in that old coal mine.
The latest attempt to sell TECO coal has failed, the Mountain Eagle reports. TECO Energy, a power utility based in Florida, has been trying for nearly a year now to sell off its coal mining operations, a group of companies known as TECO Coal. This includes Perry County Coal, Premier Elkhorn Coal, and Clintwood Elkhorn Mining, all of which operate locally. TECO had spent 8 months negotiating with Booth Energy as a potential buyer, and even offered Booth a massive discount, but that deal fell through last month. At that point, a new unnamed buyer entered the picture and said it would buy TECO Coal by July 3rd. But that deadline came and went with nothing happening. It's unclear what might happen next or when. TECO Coal is still definitely for sale, though, and either of the previous two potential buyers could still end up with the company. The Federal Abandoned Mine Lands, or AML Fund, could be used for economic recovery in the coal fields. This according to a new report from an Appalachian group called the AML Policies Priorities Group, as reported in the Charleston Gazette. This new report said there is currently $9.6 billion worth of work needed to reclaim existing abandoned mine sites, but that the AML Fund only has $2.5 billion in it, and this money will expire by 2021 if it isn't used. The report said that using AML funds could put people to work in cleaning up mine sites in Appalachia, a region that has been hard hit by coal job losses. They called on Congress to inject new funding into the AML program and to make this money more accessible to Appalachian communities that could use it. President Obama earlier this year proposed using the AML fund in this way, through a plan that would allocate $1 billion from it to employ coalfield people in cleaning up abandoned mines. But this idea has gotten little traction in Congress. Now that former state legislator Keith Hall has been found guilty of bribing a state mine inspector, that inspector might face new scrutiny from the state. The Lexington Herald Leader reports that, according to the FBI, Inspector Kelly Shortridge accepted $46,000 in bribes from Keith Hall in exchange for special treatment at mines that Hall owned in the region. But the FBI also said that Shortridge was known to make cash deposits of over $1,000 at a time within hours of having inspected various coal mines in Pike County, and not just those owned by Keith Hall. The Kentucky Energy and Environment Cabinet, which was in charge of supervising Shortridge, had previously declined to look into other misdeeds that Shortridge may have done before his recent retirement. But after Hall's trial, conviction, and the headlines surrounding the case, the cabinet says it now will be meeting with the FBI to see if Shortridge may have falsified inspection reports at other mines too. Coal production from mines with mountaintop removal permits has declined sharply in recent years compared with other types of mining. This is according to a new report from the Federal Energy Information Administration, or EIA. While overall U.S. coal production has dropped by 15% since 2008, production at mines with mountaintop removal permits has fallen by 62% over that time. The EIA didn't offer specific reasons why, but said that demand for coal has fallen across the board due to low natural gas prices, the increasing use of renewable energy, low electricity demand, and environmental regulations. According to the Charleston Gazette, scientific research in recent years has linked mountaintop removal with negative health effects in people who live nearby, including higher rates of birth defects and cancer. Earlier this year, the state of West Virginia announced that it would be reviewing this growing body of research for the sake of public health. And finally, Alpha Natural Resources has warned almost 300 local coal workers that they could soon lose their jobs. According to WYMT-TV, Alpha is trying to sell several local operations, and they expect to idle these mines and prep plants as a result. These include the North Fork No. 6 Deep Mine in Letcher County, Kentucky, the Dorchester and Osaka Deep Mines in Wise County, Virginia, the Pigeon Creek Processing Plant No. 1 in Wise County, and several mines that are already idle in Letcher County, including the Panther No. 1, Stillhouse No. 1, and North Fork No. 7 mines. Alpha said that selling these operations is consistent with its organizational philosophy in Appalachia in recent years, That is, to slim down in our region because of the weak coal market and the high expense of mining in central Appalachia. And that is the Week in Coal. For WMMT, I'm Parker Hobson.
Hammering and beating time, long for the sun, just to see it shine. And I'm down in that old coal mine.
Zero tolerance. It refers to a rule that invokes a penalty, action, or consequence without any deviation in response to a behavior, crime, condition, or transgression that is determined to be so intolerable as to warrant the harshest or most decisive response. Mandatory sentencing laws are akin to zero tolerance policies, but there are circumstances where zero tolerance makes perfect sense, like prohibitions on smoking in public buildings or airplanes, or bans prohibiting students and others from bringing guns into schools, etc. But when it comes to disciplining students for behaviors that are prohibited in schools, this can be a gray area. And where the state-mandated zero-tolerance policies apply, they have the effect of precluding a range of possible remedies other than the extremes of suspension or expulsion. So says State Representative Charlita Tavares, who serves on the state legislature's Education Committee and who introduced a bill earlier this year to overturn the state's mandatory zero-tolerance policy. Senate Bill 167 would return authority to individual schools and teachers to deal more creatively with student misconduct on a case-by-case basis. But the bill appears to have stalled at the moment for want of more widespread public support. Meanwhile, suspensions and expulsions continue. Students participating with the Freedom School in Columbus sought an audience with the state superintendent of schools on Wednesday to present their demands. We'll begin with some information about the Freedom School from Pastor April Blaine of the Summit United Methodist Church, where the Children's Defense Fund-supported 8-week summer Freedom School program convenes.
All of our scholars here are a part of a program called the Freedom Schools Program, and the Freedom Schools Program is designed to do a couple things. It's designed first to empower kids to learn to love reading, but secondly, to learn that they can really make a difference in the community. And so we've been talking with them all summer about how they can do that, and we're talking about issues in the community. And this protest today and this march was driven and led by them. It came out of issues that they've been experiencing in their schools and things that are negatively impacting their community. And they named and researched and talked about what zero tolerance policies are doing in our schools. And especially our middle school and high schoolers began to research and really look at the impact on our young people and began to make a list of demands of what they want to change in their schools. And so this is, in action, what Freedom Schools is all about, is empowering our young people to really feel like they have a voice. And they may not have a vote yet, but they have a voice. And this is the future of what will continue to shape and make our communities a different place. We want them to feel like they can be a part of it. So many of our scholars come from the Wineland Park and Linden areas, so many of the feeder schools in those communities, but lots of them go to the to charter schools and others next. Our church is located next to Graham Expeditionary and Graham Primary, so a number of them. And now you can see some of them are going in right now to speak with Richard Ross to take their list of demands to him and to speak with him, actually.
Do they actually have an appointment to speak with him?
They have an appointment, I believe, to go in and actually... I believe they're going to actually be able to speak with him and lay out their list of requests.
You're here.
About 50 students and teachers from the Freedom School marched from the State House to the Department of Education building for the meeting with Superintendent Richard Ross. Along the way, I spoke with Jabari Jackson, one of the students who was part of the delegation that would meet with Superintendent Ross.
My name is Jabari Jackson, and we're here to protest against zero tolerance policy.
And you're a student, right?
Yes, sir.
Where do you go to school?
I go to school in Reynoldsburg. Uh-huh. I go to school to Reynoldsburg High School. Uh-huh. And I'm just here to support us as a community, because there is a lot of kids out here that are just like me, that are kicked out of class just for minor reasons in the classroom. Uh-huh. And we're here to stop that, because it leads to bigger things and bigger problems that are not needed.
that's what I was going to ask is how does the zero tolerance policy affect people in your school? Like, do you know particular examples?
It's called this thing called school to prison pipeline. And zero tolerance policy is a big thing. It's a major reason on why this is happening. Uh-huh. School to prison pipeline is a system of rules and policies that keep kids out of the classroom and increases their chances of going to prison. Increases the chances of going to prison by 70%.
Mama, tell me why.
And so, if there's zero tolerance policies, there will be the school to prison pipeline will continue to go on, and we just want to stop that.
So, can you give me an example, like a scenario in which somebody might get caught up by this policy?
Okay. Say, for example, me. I'm talking to my friend a lot. And I continue to do it every single day. The teacher keeps on kicking me out of the classroom. And if I keep on getting kicked out of the classroom, it will lead to bad education. And bad education will lead to poverty. And the root of all crime is poverty. So if there's more poverty, then there's more crime. And if there's more crime, there will be more people going to jail.
And so the initial infraction would just be talking in class?
No, I mean, it is one of those things. But we also have to have the teachers understand to engage with us, to understand us as a community. So, yeah. If the teachers understand us and engage with us, I think it will make us better. It will make the communities better, and it will make the schools better. And maybe the school-to-prison pipeline will